Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
It is Sunday morning in April. This is not Rick Moore. This is Sean McCord, your reliable substitute monthly host. It has been a strange weekend, weather-wise and everything else. I won't get into my weekend because I'm only halfway through it. I am sitting here in the studios of 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, with my friend Charles Blue, who is the public information officer for the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. Charles, he said, I can also just refer to you as the science writer.
Yes, the science writer, the science guy. My job is to basically take all that crazy stuff that the astrophysicists are looking at and make it understandable, exciting, and fun.
That sounds kind of like an awesome job.
It's not bad. You get to do a lot of cool things. It's like learning a new course in science every day, and you get to actually learn about the science, but you don't have to sit down and do the math.
So I told a few people, I told everybody I ran into that I was going to be doing the show today, and a surprising number of people said the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, the NRAO.
NRAO, yeah.
What is the NRAO? We've seen the buildings out on Ivy Road.
Yeah.
Well, is it the federal government? Is it the university? Is it funded by Black Ops?
No, not that exciting. It's actually funded by the National Science Foundation, NSF. Mm-hmm. And we've been around since the 1950s. We started out in Green Bank, West Virginia, because that's really a fantastic place to put a radio telescope. But at one point, they moved the offices here to Charlottesville. So we're on campus, but we're not part of UVA. And we have an engineering lab in town where we actually design and build some of the most sophisticated radio technology on Earth.
Okay, I want to get back to that in a second.
Sure.
But we don't have any telescopes here in town.
No, this would be a really rotten place to put one.
Why is that? Because of the mountains? Well, because of the atmosphere?
There's a lot of reasons, but these telescopes, if you combine all the energy received by them, it would be less than the energy of a single snowflake hitting the ground. These things are so sensitive that if you put one here, all it would pick up is the static and the electrical noise of town. You got to put them someplace where, it's like putting an optical telescope in the middle of like a light store.
Las Vegas.
Yeah, exactly. It's not going to do you a lot of good.
Right. So they have to be out, say, in the middle of the desert.
In the middle of the desert.
Like in New Mexico.
In New Mexico, in the mountains of Chile, in West Virginia, where there's low population density, lots of mountains, and you're also in the National Radio Quiet Zone.
Right.
So you ever drive out there, your cell phone will be useless. They have no Wi-Fi. They have no radio technologies that would interfere with the telescope. It's meant to make sure that that investment can actually study what's happening out in space.
Well, we have pockets of that in Charlottesville. But
we're on the outskirts of it, so we're on the kind of the far end here. But really, it doesn't mean that there's no transmission. It just means that if there's a fixed transmitter, we try and make sure it doesn't interfere with observations.
So a few years ago, I was driving through the American Southwest, and I visited the very large array.
Yeah, VLA.
In the VLA. Is it in New Mexico?
It's in New Mexico, yes. Yeah. Corona, Mexico.
So, people who saw the movie Contact, this is our second time we referenced the movie Contact with Jodie Foster,
yes.
Because apparently that's the theme of what we do here, is to mention that film. Is there association with the Very Large Array, the VLA?
Yeah, it's actually one of our telescopes. We operate four of them. One of them is the VLA, which is one of the most productive telescopes on Earth. It's pushback science. What we know about the universe now, so much of that is dependent on what the VLA discovered.
Mm-hmm.
So we have that. We have the Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia, which is monstrosity. This thing is huge. It's taller than the Statue of Liberty. Its dish could hold the stadium pretty much here at UVA.
So you could play football.
You wouldn't want to, but it's a massive telescope. Very, very, very powerful. We also have something that you can't really look at and point at and say, there it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the VLBA. Yeah, lots of letters here, letter soup, but it's
very large bitchin' array.
It's something like that, but very long baseline array. Baseline.
I was so close.
Yeah, so close. But it's 10 antennas from Hawaii to St. Croix,
mm-hmm.
and it operates as one telescope. So it is the best resolution telescope on Earth. And we have the headquarters here, and also the one in the most sophisticated telescope on Earth, ALMA. And that's a new telescope. It's in the Atacama Desert of Chile. And wow, what a place to visit. It's amazing.
So the NRAO, I'm not going right. to try to say the full name anymore. The NRAO oversees all these telescopes now. Right. But NASA runs the Hubble Space Telescope.
Yeah, if it's on the ground, pretty much.
Sure.
NSF runs it, National Science Foundation. If it's in space, mostly NASA. There's some wiggle room in there, but that's pretty much, you know, that's the dividing line if you think about it that way.
So the NRAO, what is the association between the NRAO here in Charlottesville and the University of Virginia?
We're on campus, so we lease the space, and mm-hmm. you know, some of our staff members serve on faculty, so there's a lot of cooperation, but we're not part of UVA. We are definitely part of the National Science Foundation, but being on campus, being at UVA is fantastic. They've got one of the top astronomy departments in the United States, so there's a lot of cross-pollination, a lot of collaboration, and you know, it's a fantastic place to be able to do this work.
And you mentioned, okay, now we'll get back to the work.
Yeah.
You mentioned the engineering here and some of the equipment that they're building. What can you tell me about?
Well, it's not a secret.
It's
you know?
A top
no,
secret?
No, no,
okay,
no, no,
right,
no, nothing
cool.
secret there. No, but essentially, to do radio astronomy, to do this stuff, you have to build components that are incredibly precise, incredibly clean. These things also have to operate at just a few degrees above absolute zero.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Well, everything that has a temperature gives off radio waves, and if you build a component and it's too warm in its environment, all it's going to pick up is
itself.
The stuff around it.
Sure.
It's, you know, which is kind of pointless. But yeah, you know, we have some incredibly talented engineers, technicians, and scientists here who crank out just really some of the best equipment. There was a discovery maybe a decade ago. This was WMAP. It was a satellite that actually took a picture of the afterglow of the Big Bang. So it was the here's the afterglow, the microwave background.
So when after the Big Bang, when the universe is sitting back and smoking a cigarette.
It's kind of like that, yeah. But this is when it cooled down enough that you could actually get light. NASA sent this satellite up. It did fantastic work. But the receivers, the part that actually did the work on that, were built here in Charlottesville. So,
nice.
You know, we do some really quality, you know, just really the best engineering on radio equipment ever.
So you're funded by the National Science Foundation. The
yes.
National Science Foundation, is that a federal agency?
It is, yeah. And they offer grants to people who do fundamental basic scientific research in mm-hmm. physics, astronomy, biology, geophysics, the whole thing. And this is just, you know, one small part of what they do.
So when the NRAO builds an original or custom piece of equipment, because they're funded by the ultimately by the federal government, can they patent anything?
We do have patents, and I'm not really the expert on how that whole
Fair
thing
enough.
Works. But
Fair enough.
But yes, there are. We do get a number of patents. There's also, you know, the government encourages this technology sharing program.
Mm-hmm.
So there's ways that this actually makes it out into the marketplace. But again, that's not
your area.
Yeah.
But when you say technology sharing, is that with private corporations like SpaceX, we'll get to them in a second, is it with other agencies,
yeah,
other nations?
It can be with private companies, and of course this all happens with, you know, the oversight of the government. We actually have a few news items on our website that talk about some of the recent events like that, where we've actually had a technology was developed, it mm-hmm. was patented, and you know, now it's out there being in the marketplace.
Well, good. I want to get to some of those news items in a few moments, because you sent me some.
Yeah, we're doing some really amazing things. We're just discovering some stuff that just will blow your mind. It's pretty amazing.
Well, good. Prepare to have your mind blown on with Charles Blue, the NRAO, on 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, and the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. This is your host, Sean McCord. But let's talk a little bit about you. You're the public information officer.
That's the title, yes.
AKA science writer.
Yeah.
How long have you been in our NRAO?
This is actually my second time around. I was here about 10, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Put in three and a half years. And then I got called up to NSF, National Science Foundation headquarters, and I worked there for a number of years as a program officer. And then I worked on TMT, the 30-meter telescope, which is one that they're trying to build. That sounds big. Yes, it's an optical telescope. And they're looking at the original effort was to try and build it in Hawaii on Mauna Kea.
Mm-hmm.
But they're now kind of looking at other sites as well. So I worked there for a number of years.
Wait, you worked in Hawaii?
The headquarters there was in Pasadena, but I got stuck going to Hawaii maybe 10 times in the course of a year.
Yeah, that sounds terrible.
It's a long flight for a meeting in a windowless office, I'll tell you that. So, yeah, I got to the beach once.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was a lot of red-eye flights and not a lot of sun.
All right. So then you came back here.
Yeah. Yeah, I came back here. They brought ALMA, the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array Telescope, online, and needed somebody to help with the publicity for that, to work with our international partners, and it's really just too exciting. So yeah,
So you do publicity for science.
Do publicity for science,
man. I tell you, my dream job is like one of these science reporters in NPR who just have to go find the coolest new science and then try to make it explicable to the public.
And these guys are incredibly talented too. A lot of it's playing news ferret as well. You know, if it's really scientifically interesting, sometimes it's hard to make it broadly approachable to people. And sometimes the most broadly approachable things may not be the most scientifically earth-shattering and important. But sometimes they are. So it's really a job of figuring out what we do that's going to be of interest, and also finding the important things and making that exciting to other people.
Well, I mean, sure, I can understand, especially when you're looking at the origins of the universe or heat death of the universe, that it becomes a little bit too big to comprehend. So part of your job is making it comprehensible.
That's it. Yes. And sometimes these things are a little hard to wrap your head around. Absolutely. Yeah. But as we say in astronomy, there are no dumb questions. It's over everyone's head.
There we go. So, first of all, I want to thank you. You were originally scheduled to be here in January, and then you got bumped by the mayor because I had contacted Mike Signer's office during the election, and after he got on the council and then was selected to be mayor, I did a follow-up, and he had agreed to come on the show. But I'm actually kind of glad that I bumped you because we would not have been able to talk about the graviton waves.
The gravitational waves.
Waves, which you knew about, right?
Not in advance. I mean, I knew there was going to be an announcement about LIGO, the observatory, but...
Okay, what's LIGO?
LIGO is... now I have to remember exactly. Laser Interferometry Gravity Wave Observatory.
Of course.
And this is
Charles.
This is one of these NSF-funded facilities, and they have two detectors. And these essentially are like L-shaped projections of lasers, and they can detect fluctuations that are smaller than the center of an atom. These things are incredibly precise. And what they detected at both of these is a little bit of wiggle in the universe. And, you know, you drop a pebble in a pond, you see the waves go out.
Right.
Well, if you do something really incredibly powerful in the distant universe, the actual fabric of space and time itself kind of stretches and contracts, and we get waves of gravity, gravitational waves. And they detected it for the first time. And Einstein predicted this about 100 years ago, so it took that long to have the technology to make that discovery.
So how was that discovery made?
This is a difficult thing. But if you have two light waves, and you've got up, down, up, down, up, down.
Mm-hmm.
Like noise-canceling headphones, if you put the exact opposite wavelength in, it cancels things out. Same thing happens with light. So if these things are working right, they'll get this nice pattern. But if they shift a little bit, the pattern goes away. So it's like a little noise-canceling. And as these gravitational waves kind of wash over Earth and kind of squish it and expand it, those waves of light can be just pushed back and forth enough that you get a signal. And if it happens at both detectors, they can see if it was actually not a background thing, but actually a gravitational wave. And that's kind of what they did.
So these gravitational waves, and visualize it. I can visualize it like an animation. In fact, you sent me a link, and there was actually, if you go to the NRAO website.
That's actually a little different, but we can talk about that. Just like there's different colors of light. And you can there's red to ultraviolet, and some are short and some are long. Different types of gravitational waves. And actually at NRAO, we're looking for mega ripples in space-time. These things are, instead of really, really short like the ones LIGO detected, we're looking for ones that are light years long. And these are called nanohertz gravitational waves. And because they're so big, you can't build a detector big enough to detect them.
Well, I was just going to ask, if they're so big, why are they so hard to find?
Ah, well, you need a detector that's big enough to detect the wave. So you need something that's bigger than Earth. You need something that's bigger than the solar system. You need something even bigger than that.
So it needs to be huge.
It needs
the best.
Huge is an understatement. You can't... It's not a wall. You can't build this thing. And no one else is going to pay for it. But fortunately, it already exists in a way.
Oh, really?
There are things called pulsars. You may have heard of these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everybody hears of pulsars.
I know what they are, but why don't you explain it to one or two people?
Well, you get a giant star, you blow it up.
Awesome.
Yeah, well, we do that all the time. Well, it happens not infrequently in the universe. What you have left over is a very dense core, and it spins incredibly fast. Hundreds of times each second, and its magnetic field sends out these pulses of radio waves, and they're incredibly precise. They're as precise as an atomic clock. These things are scattered all over the sky. Well, if you measure these pulses from various pulsars spread across our galaxy, if a gravitational wave, these long wavelength ones, comes passing by and kind of just affects Earth a little bit, that tiny distortion should be detectable in the time it takes the pulses to get there. So if we look at these pulsars and we go, there's just a little something weird happening here all the way around, that might be the signal that a gravitational wave has passed by. So we've got two telescopes. We've got and the Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia is actually involved in this search. And we're just kind of getting started. So
sure, but I mean, it's gravitational waves aren't like waves crashing on the beach.
No.
It would be like if you were in the middle of the ocean... the tide, you know, brought you up and down a little bit, but you're kind of riding the wave at the same time. So you have to have an objective somewhere else even to measure that.
Yeah. You can't really detect it unless you kind of see something far enough away. And that's really what you have. The length is the key in this one. But imagine you're made out of water and then the wave comes by. That's kind of more...
Right.
More to the point, because it's not a wave washing over you. It's actually you, the universe, the Earth, everything kind of just rippling. And you wonder why I don't get sleep at night. I stop worrying about these things.
The man worrying about these things is Charles Blue of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. You're on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome back. It's the Sunday morning wake-up call. My guest is Charles Blue at the NRAO. Okay, so I got to sort of put my brains back into my head.
Let's get back to Earth.
Let's get back to Earth a little bit. Let's talk about the scientific method.
Okay.
Because I know there's a lot of misunderstanding about that and just what it is scientists do.
We science is what we do.
We science hard. Yeah. You'll often hear people who are, let us say, perhaps unacquainted with the scientific method say something like, "Well, that's just a theory."
So what is
the theory and how's it fit into the scientific
method? Let's start by saying science isn't a thing. It's not a body of knowledge. It's a great way of life is what it is, but it's also a way of looking at the universe. It's a process. It's the way that you try and find the actual truth about nature, but it's not so much as like, well, you believe in it or not. It is actually the process by which you do investigation where you try to prove yourself wrong and you try to find evidence contrary to what you're doing. So you are absolutely sure when you get to the end that what you have found is as provisionally true as it can be. And science changes, our scientific knowledge changes, but the scientific method stays the same because we get better data and we can sort of retool and understand better. So, for example, when we had Newton and his theory of gravity, fantastic scientific method. And
which technically is still a theory, right?
Yes, it is. And, Joe, the theory of gravity is still the theory of gravity. So if you don't believe in it, you still kind of get hit in the head by a rock if somebody drops it on you. That's the nice thing about science. Whether or not you believe in it or not, it will affect your life directly. But Newton's theory on gravity, absolutely certain and true, but it didn't explain everything. So then we had Einstein come along and said, well, you know, gravity is more than just this instantaneous force. It takes time to get from one point to another. It's the actual bending of the universe So, you know, our scientific understanding changed as our knowledge changed, as our ability to do experiments changed, much like the detection of gravitational waves just a month and a half ago. They were predicted, mm-hmm. but never detected.
Right.
So now we've detected them, and now we can actually get out there and start doing more science, learning more about the nature of space and time.
So the detection of gravitational waves
yes.
strengthens
the theory
of the theory of relativity.
Yes.
But the theory of relativity is still a theory because you're still testing it.
And don't confuse theory with hypothesis. This
right.
is where language
right.
changes. You know, it's funny, in different areas you use words to mean different things.
Mm-hmm.
And in literature and philosophy, maybe you use the word theory kind of loosely. It's like, well, I was sitting down and I had this theory about, you know, if I mix Coke and Pepsi together, I'd have the best tasting soda in the world. That failed. No, you don't. But in science, the theory means that you have come up with a hypothesis, you have tested it, and it has passed every test up to this point. It is the best explanation for observations and experiments. That's what a theory is in science. It's not a hypothesis. It's not a guess. It's not a speculation. It's really well-founded, and it is not just supported by one little piece of data. It's a confluence. It's all these things coming together that strengthen the idea that make it a theory.
So the reason I get into this is because I think first of all, there's a lot of confusion about what the scientific method is, and because the language doesn't always translate. So, and I'm going to get into, you're a scientist and a science writer. I'm going to get into an area that kind of overlaps into politics, and you're representing the NRA. So it's perfectly fine if you step back and say, I don't really want to get into that. But, for example, there were theories about the effects of climate change that came out in the 70s and the 80s. I remember doing a report in grade school on ecology and the impact we were having on our environment. And back in the 80s, it was referred to, climate change was referred to in the media as global warming.
Right.
And now, you know, we had a really cold day yesterday. We've had senators bring snowballs into Congress and say, see, it's snowing outside, therefore the earth isn't warming. So part of it is just language. Now, many people don't refer to global warming anymore. They refer to climate change. It wasn't that they got it wrong in the 80s. It's that the theory was incomplete.
Exactly. Right.
Right.
And so much of these things are based on computer models.
Mm-hmm. And computers have gotten a little better since the 80s, too.
They've gotten much better, and the computations have gotten better, and the models have gotten better. But looking back at an earlier time in my life, uh-huh. I was working for the National Academy of Engineering, part of the National Academy of Sciences. And I was at a meeting of the American Meteorological Association, and the president at the time of that group was Bob Ryan. And he's talking about, okay, so we've got an Earth, and it's a set distance from a sun, and you tilt it on an axis, and you start spinning it. Well, you put ice on the top and the bottom, you give it an atmosphere, you put clouds on it, you put mountains and you put water, and you want to know the temperature in Detroit a week from Tuesday. It's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
But when you start making predictions and they start from models and they start coming true and you start observing the changes, then you have more confidence in the models. But it's a very difficult thing to explain because just as you say, you can go outside, you can say, wow, I was cold yesterday. But because you were cold yesterday doesn't necessarily mean that somebody in Mexico was cold or that it wasn't uncommonly hot or the ocean wasn't changing. So we have a limited capacity to take in information. That's part of being human. And it's difficult to really wrap your head around the whole global phenomenon of climate.
Sure. And also the models, as they got better, have predicted predicted an overall increase in temperature of the Earth, but that doesn't mean we'll never have any cold days anymore. In fact, cold days and big storms fit entirely in those models.
And also, trends fluctuate. You have hot years, cold years in mm-hmm. astrophysics. You have, if you're looking at the sun, it's the sunspots are heavy, some spots are low. So it's not the 10-year pattern. It's not the 20-year pattern. It's the 100-year patterns that are important. And again, that's a lot of information and references to keep in your mind. So it's easy to kind of get lost in anecdotal evidence rather than the broader scheme of it. So, you know, that's about what I can mention on that topic. Models are great, and the science in it, the theory of it, isn't just one observation. It's all these other things that come together to support it.
Well, but I bring this up specifically not just to talk about climate change, but to talk about the position you may find yourself in as a science writer when you're trying to explain science where science overlaps with public policy. Scientists don't always do themselves a favor because they live in a scientific world, and by the way, disagree with me.
I'm at this point. I'm just listening to the commentary. Because again, this is really getting a bit, you know, far afield. I mean, Paul.
How do you struggle as a science writer with making science not only understandable, but when you hear politicians, when you hear lawmakers disagree with basic science, how do you try to bridge that? Do you find yourself wanting to sort of bridge that gap to go from explaining science to impacting policy?
As part of the NSF, policy is just not in my portfolio. My job really is to make sure that the public understands as best they can what we're trying to do, mm-hmm. and the discoveries we're trying to make, and really what science is contributing broadly. It's doing some fantastic things. Even the work, you know, you may think that astronomy is some sort of like over your head, very out there sort of thing, but the discoveries that were being made help us understand our place in the cosmos. They help us understand the evolution of the universe. They help us understand the evolution of our planet by looking at the way other planets form and evolve. So my job in that is to worry more about the way that I can make that more approachable. So people see that and go, that's really exciting. I want to learn more about that. I want to read more about that. I want to understand the science better. I want to know why I should care. I want to tell other people about it. And that's really the best that I can do, is to make something that's fun, exciting to read, approachable. Somebody's going to go home and, hey, guess what I learned today when I was listening to the radio? This is exciting. Talk to their families about it. That's, as a science writer, that's really my goal, is to hit that.
Excellent. Thank you. That's where I wanted to get to. So let's go back to that.
Okay.
What's some of the most interesting news that came out in science this week?
Well, we have, I love planet formation, mm-hmm. and so should you. But the whole process of looking at planets in formation is it's a new field, and we need radio telescopes to do this. One of the interesting things is most of the stuff that you see in outer space in pictures from like Hubble and the big ground-based telescopes like Keck, these are stuff that are shining, they're bright, they're either emitting light or they're reflecting light from stars. Planets form around protostars, and they're not really that bright. This is the cold, dark stuff that you can't see with your eyes. So radio telescopes actually see that because they shine really brightly in that wavelength. Mm. So we are now being able to see planets in formation. We're now being able to see these disks of planet-forming stuff. It's dust and gas starting to coalesce and form what may be, you know, Earth 2.0 at some point. We've actually found this is actually very near to us. It's a forming solar system, and it's
in our galaxy.
In our galaxy, and we found a gap in a disk. It's, you know, if you play records, you see gaps in disks, but that gap is the same distance from that star as the Earth is from the sun. So that says there's probably a planet forming there. So it may be a planet that could come back a few million years, a few hundred million years, kind of look like a young Earth. We don't know that for sure because we can't really see that, but we can see the gap where the planet's forming for the first time, and this is really kind of exciting.
It is exciting. Let's do some math here, because these numbers kind of boggle my mind. No, easy numbers. How old is the universe?
Older than I am. It's we're looking at about, I always get that mixed up, around 13.8 billion years.
Right.
And give or take.
And
a week or two.
And our planet.
It's about 4.6 billion years old.
Okay. You were talking about protostar earlier.
Yes.
So that's when material is collapsing into the center and forming.
Yeah. You get a big ball of stuff, and mm-hmm. it's mostly gas, mm-hmm. mostly hydrogen, some helium, a few other things mixed in, and the leftover ash from other stars that have exploded, the dust. And this stuff starts to collapse because we got gravity. Gravity mm-hmm. brings things together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like a ice skater pulling in his arms, it starts to spin faster. Well, it starts to spin and you get a lot of stuff coming in the center. You get enough stuff there, enough gas. You get a protostar that will eventually become a star like a sun. And all the other stuff in the disk on the outside forms planets like Earth, Mercury, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn.
So a lot of those
takes time.
Formed from that same cloud.
Formed from that stuff, yes. Formed from that same stuff. Now, most of the gas goes into the center, forms this star. Mm-hmm. You get enough of it, you get fusion. The hydrogen atoms bang together, form helium in the center of it, and you get heat, light, just what you need for a planet.
Right. I want to get back to that in a second, but I want to get back to the numbers.
Yeah.
I know from Star Trek that we live on a Class M planet. That refers to the size, the gravitational, the fact that we have water, liquid water, et cetera.
Yeah.
Theoretically, I know we don't have an exact number, but theoretically, right. What is the model for how many Class M planets might be in our galaxy?
That is a Star Trek term, not a scientific term, okay, but we'll let that slide. you know, I don't really know.
Okay.
But what I do know is that...
I mean, does anybody know?
You know, there are probably some models that mm-hmm. that predict that, but it's got a big margin of error. So
sure.
Because, you know, being able to see planets, we're just starting to see them. It's on the hairy edge of detection on even the best telescopes. But what we can do is with things like Kepler, which is looking at...
What's Kepler?
Kepler is a satellite that NASA put up mm-hmm. that looks for just the subtle dimming of a star when a planet passes in front of it. So there's lots of ways to look for planets. One of them is, if it's a really big planet, its gravity tugs on the star a little bit to the left, it tugs on a little bit to the right, and by looking at the wobble of the star, you can detect a planet around it. Kepler looks at the light, and just like a little something going in front of a light in your house, it dims the light a little bit. So by studying that subtle dimming of these various stars that it's looking at, it can say that, hey, a planet's just passed in front of that. And what we're seeing is that pretty much most stars seem to have planets, and we didn't know that. So the chances are getting better and better that there are these Earth-like planets.
Fair enough. That's really where I was going. How many stars in our galaxy?
Depends how you count them, but we're looking at hundreds of billions.
Hundreds of billions, and how many galaxies have we detected?
Hundreds of billions.
So hundreds of billions of stars and hundreds of billions of galaxies.
Yeah.
So the universe is a mind-blowingly big place.
And that's... What is the universe? I wish I knew that, but we know the observable universe.
Right.
And that's what we can see. So it may, you know...
There may be more...
Yes.
Not just maybe. There's more out there.
There's more to it, but there's a limit to what...
Because we can...
Because of the speed of light,
We can only see a bubble at which we are the center.
At which we are the center. But we're not the center of the universe.
No. Yes. And the edges of the bubble are 13.8 billion years.
Right. Yes.
So we can only theorize what is beyond that bubble.
Pretty much. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And again, it's the Big Bang was not a place. The universe didn't start in a place. It started in time. So it's all the universe expanding. So it's
again, we're getting into I'm resisting the temptation to lapse over from science into philosophy, but. And then religion and all that other stuff. But okay, let's go to the Big Bang, because Big Bang, you know, when I get into heated discussions with people who, again, are perhaps not fully acquainted with science, they'll say, well, science can't, you know, science says, you know, the universe couldn't have just been created out of nothing. Scientists can't say what was there before the Big Bang. And the answer is exactly right.
Yes.
We don't know what was there. We barely know what was there. I mean, we can talk about what was there a few milliseconds after the Big Bang.
You can, yeah, the models actually are pretty good at this incredibly hot, incredibly dense soup of particles. We can actually look to the edge of this cosmic microwave background. This mm-hmm. is the leftover afterglow of the Big Bang, and we can actually see that. It's imprinted on the sky. If you have an old television that gets a static station, a small percentage of that, that hiss, that snow on your screen, is the leftover radiation from the Big Bang, which, you know, if you want to see nothing's on TV, well, you can watch the beginning of the universe. You know, that's not a bad thing.
Okay, so when the universe is 1 second old, how big is it?
I don't know. It's actually fairly enormous at that point because the theory of inflation comes into that. Mm-hmm. And that is to say, at the fraction of a second after the Big Bang, the universe just grew by ginormous proportions, faster than
the speed of light.
Yeah, the universe itself grew.
How is that possible?
I don't know. I wasn't there, but it is actually a theory that is kind of borne out by a lot of observations. Mm-hmm. And this is not to say that when we have better observations that won't change, but the theory of inflation is basically in the tiniest fraction of a second after the Big Bang, the universe went from something infinitesimally small to something so enormously huge that you can't observe it all at once. So it is really one of the best ways to sort of predict the way that we see our universe today is generally pretty smooth, but with bits of lumpy stuff in it too that gave rise to the galaxies and the stars and the planets and the people like you and me.
All right. We're going to go to gonna break in just a minute. You're listening to... Oh man, my mind is expanding.
It's not Carl Sagan, no.
You're listening to the Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. It is the Sunday morning Wake Up Call. I am picking up my brains off the floor and shoving them back into my skull because this sort of stuff fascinates me, but also boggles me every time. So, okay, how do we know that the universe is expanding?
Well, we've known the universe is expanding for quite a while. Edwin Hubble mm-hmm. Took a look at galaxies, and he noticed that those that were further away are moving away faster than those that are closer. So, you know, it's kind of weird. Einstein thought the universe was probably stable. It wasn't expanding. It wasn't contracting. It was as it is.
The old steady state.
Yeah, the
universe.
Old steady state. Yeah, mm-hmm.
He got that one wrong.
Well, he kind of got it wrong. He kind of got it right. When he did his math, it showed that either the universe was expanding or contracting. So he put in this cosmological constant, a kind of a fix for it. Say, okay, this will balance it out. That comes back later to haunt us. But when Hubble took a look at these galaxies and noticed that they were receding, and the ones that were further were receding faster... Well, play that in reverse.
Mm-hmm.
Things start moving closer and closer together. And every time we look at more evidence, that's definitely the case. So, yes, the universe is expanding. It's also expanding faster the farther out you go. So not only is it expanding, but that expansion is accelerating.
Well, that's new. The acceleration is relatively new.
The acceleration
our discovery.
Yes.
So the edges of the universe, whatever that is, as they accelerate away from the center of the universe,
the point in time at which the universe began.
Right.
Yes. All points are expanding
right.
away,
and they're expanding away faster.
What? How is that? And you believe me, when astronomers, scientists first looked at the data, they're like, that can't be right.
No, because something wrong with that.
Yeah, so you had this initial force, this Big Bang, and mm-hmm. then there's gravity. Gravity should be pulling back. The universe expansion should probably be slowing. Something should be happening. So when they looked farther out, they started looking at things called type 1A supernovas, another big word. But when these stars explode, type 1A supernovas, we know how bright they're supposed to be. And some of the distant ones were, you know, just a little dimmer than they should have been. And this was a pretty consistent result that different observing groups found independently. And what that basically indicated was not only is the universe expanding, but it's starting to expand faster the farther out you go. And this is that thing called dark energy. It may not be dark, it may not be energy, but there's a lot of it out there.
Right. Okay. So, because I remember when I was studying this in college, the prevailing theories, there was the prevailing theories were either that the explosive force of the universe was big enough that all the galaxies would just keep rushing away from each other and eventually
slow down,
slow down and die a heat death, or they weren't rushing away from each other fast enough and eventually would slow down and start to collapse
to the big crunch eventually.
And that was actually kind of a satisfying theory. It's like,
yeah, it's like goes back, collapses, and then maybe it'll start all over again.
Right. So then there's this new observation that says, oh, guess what? They're both wrong.
Yes, they're both wrong.
And the models we had in science class of blowing up a balloon with little dots on it to show how we're expanding away from each other, it's like, wait a minute, the balloon is just filling up faster and faster.
Yeah, it's like you're opening up the valve faster and faster as it's expanding.
Right, so where is that expansion coming from? And that is the dark energy.
And it looks like, hey, let's go back to that conversation we had a few minutes ago. It could be this cosmological constant that Einstein threw in back then. That's one of the possibilities.
Which had been... He threw in there because he couldn't explain things and then been dismissed.
Yeah, so he called it his greatest blunder, and then it's sort of like, well, even in a mistake, Einstein comes out and provides some sort of insights. The math is just amazing. So that's what the observations are showing, is that there is this dark energy that is increasing the expansion of the universe. So instead of this steady state, slow death, and maybe the big crunch, maybe we go to a big rip and things just kind of fly apart. But that's trillions of years into the future.
It's a long time.
I'm not going to worry about it. I got taxes to pay this week.
So is this a good time to be in science?
The instruments are getting better. And that's basically like saying we can find out things with so much more precision. Really exciting. Every couple hundred years, somebody predicts it's the end of science,
right?
And they're wrong again. We've got the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, which is looking at incredibly small things, and then we're looking at things that are at the edge of the observable universe. So you're going quarks to the cosmos, and by these big telescopes, these big accelerators, we're really learning that the universe is a lot more complicated than we first thought. We're learning that every day. There's always something new,
right? And also, the sort of overlap of continuing overlap of science and industry, but you may have been along with me watching the SpaceX disposable rocket.
Yeah,
land.
A lot of high fives on that one.
Yeah. Well, for those who may have missed it, tell us what that was about.
Well, this was a sort of a joint NASA and private venture with SpaceX to, after you launch something, well, what do you do with the first stage of the rocket?
Mm-hmm.
These things are expensive. It would be nice if you could reuse them. But
we used to just drop them in the ocean or have them burn up in the atmosphere.
Yeah. And if you look at these old 1950s science fiction movies, they have the rocket shoot up and then land back down on the planet or back on Earth. And that was a great idea at the time. Well, they've actually landed one that way. And they've landed on this sort of remote controlled platform out in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And they stuck the landing, and that was really an engineering achievement, a technology achievement, it was a computing achievement, and it may pave the way for using these things as reusable and saving money, making getting up in space less expensive, which is all good. So, big high fives to all my friends out there working on that project.
And it was great TV.
It was great. Oh, it's fascinating. You're watching that, then you
cheer. There's no way.
Yeah.
There's no way.
Oh, my gosh. They stuck the landing.
Yeah.
The Olympic judges hold up 10.0 and everyone goes home happy.
So, okay. So that was just a few days ago. Let's just go to a couple of other news releases,
a couple
of other things that you've been working on.
Sure. Oh, for me.
I'm giving you a softball.
I appreciate that. One of the things that I think is really fascinating is that our galaxy, the Milky Way, you kind of think of it as this island in the universe, but it's not. It's buzzing with lots of other stuff around it. We've got dwarf galaxies. We've got...
What are dwarf galaxies?
Dwarf galaxies
and are there more than seven of them?
Yes, we've got Sleepy Sneak. No, but we've got, you've got the Large Magellanic Cloud, Small Magellanic Cloud. So there are these satellite galaxies, much smaller, but galaxies nonetheless that that hover around the Milky Way. They're locked to it gravitationally. And there's one that we look at with the Green Bank Telescope that it's an object that has no stars in it, or at least none that we can detect. It's called the Smith Cloud. And this thing was it's on a collision course back with the Milky Way. So I think in about 30 million years, it's supposed to collide again with the Milky Way galaxy and might set off this burst of star formation. Nowhere near us, but things fall into the galactic disk all the time. But recently, we've taken a look at this thing with not just the Green Bank Telescope, which can actually detect the hydrogen gas that's in this enormous object, but they looked at it with the Hubble Space Telescope. And they were able to detect the light coming through it from distant stars, and they found that it's got stuff in it that they didn't expect to find. Sulfur. So when light passes through things, you know, like using spectroscopy, you can detect, you can detect what type of chemicals are in it. And if this thing were pristine, if it were just formed out of the primordial hydrogen of the universe around our Milky Way galaxy, it shouldn't have that, because you can only get that from stars. The fact that this has sulfur in it, in the same kind of density as you would find in the outer disk, means that, one, it either kind of got belched out by our galaxy, and our galaxy does belch things out once in a while with supernovas and star formation.
So it's a galactic fart.
Somebody else said that, not me. But what also may have happened is this could have plunged through our galaxy. It could be a dark dwarf galaxy. It could be something that has enough dark matter. We didn't talk about that yet, sorry, but it could have enough dark matter that it maintained its shape enough after it plunged through the galaxy's disk and is now circling back around to come back. But that was probably like 70 million years ago. So it's,
so we missed it. Okay.
Yeah,
we talked about dark energy, which is energy that we can detect the effects, but we don't know where it's coming from.
Right.
What is this dark matter of which you speak?
Yes. Well, the stuff that has gravity, the goodly portion of it, the majority of this, like maybe 80% of the matter in the universe, is dark. That means it doesn't, to the best of our knowledge, interact with light. And we know it's there because it has a whopping amount of gravity. And so gravity is...
So when we're trying to measure the mass of the universe, the expected mass of the universe is bigger than what we can detect.
It's bigger than what we can see. It's bigger than what we can see.
Right.
Yeah. So dark matter is you know, there are theories on what it could be. One of them is it could be just a particular particle that's incredibly difficult to detect. And there are some very difficult particles to detect. And it doesn't interact at least easily with light, but it does have appreciable mass. So this was something that, where they were looking at galaxies, Vera Rubin and others, you know, the astronomers decades ago, and like, well, if the galaxy's moving that fast, it should be kind of flying apart. It shouldn't stay together. There's not enough gravity to keep it together, but it was. So they said, well, there's got to be this dark matter, stuff we can't see. And maybe it's just, you know, black holes, and maybe it's just gas that we can't see, but it's something. So now we know that this dark matter is actually a major component of the universe.
So the universe is expanding faster than our earlier models had told us. So there's some kind of invisible force.
A lot of forces are invisible. This is one of them, yes.
This is what we call dark energy. And the mass of the universe is greater than we were able to observe.
Well, the mass was there. We just, the part of it that's, there's a goodly part of it that you can't observe with regular telescopes.
You said 80%.
Of the mass, yes. You know, if you look at, if you combine matter energy and include dark energy, it's a much smaller. But, you know, if you combine the stuff, you know, pinch yourself in the arm, this stuff and the stuff in stars and planets and dark matter, the stuff that makes up you and me is a really tiny portion of what's in the universe.
So is there, other than the sort of the coincidence of the names, is there a relation between dark matter and dark energy?
It's a dark makes an excellent placeholder when you can't really that when you haven't had the detection yet. So yes.
So semantically there is.
Yes, semantically they're very closely related, but as far as what they are as a phenomenon,
we don't know.
We don't know. Certainly doesn't appear that way. One definitely is matter, and the other is an energy of some sort that
So you have to be pinned down. So you are not a theoretical scientist. You are.
My background's more in geology, actually. So
right,
I've just been a science writer for 25 years. So I've read this stuff.
Are there prevailing theories
for dark matter?
For dark matter and dark energy?
Yeah, I mean, for dark matter, I mean, it could be a particle.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly could be an undetected particle. It could be things like, there was things called MACHOs, massive halo objects, sort of like brown dwarfs, things that are not quite heavy enough to be stars, but they still have a lot of mass, and maybe there'd be enough of those things to hold the galaxy together. There still might be a lot more of those, but I think the particle theory is probably gaining a little more prevalence. So, yeah, there are theories, and, you know, these are testable. We can actually test them, with the Large Hadron Collider, hopefully they'll get a little headway in that. Dark energy? Mm-hmm. But that's still over my head too. We'll talk to the theoreticians about that.
All right. Well, we'll have you back in a million years or so to talk about this.
Yeah, I'll need my hearing aid by then.
So you've got kids, plural.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you want them to get into science?
Yes, I would. Who can predict the other kids? But it really is exciting. There's new things happening. There's opportunities. And
That's what I'm really asking.
Yeah, there's opportunities and there's things that you science. Can, when you discover something, you add to the human ball of knowledge. And mm-hmm. that's really very exciting. And it can be in incremental ways. It could be by big discoveries. You can get your name on something that's never been seen before, or you can just really enjoy the process and learning and working with some amazing people who have passion. These people don't show up to, oh gosh, it's Monday. No, it's like, it's Monday. We've got telescopes. We've got observations to make. We've got images to observe. And it's a place with a lot of passion, a lot of desire to really push understanding. So yeah, it would be it's a great career. Absolutely.
And that's why I asked for two reasons. One, because I think, we are fortunate enough to live in a town like Charlottesville with a big university here.
Right.
So, we're not all football.
But it's good. I like football.
Sure, absolutely. But there are a lot of options for people in a town like this, and one of this is the sciences. And the scientists I meet, whether they're working with telescopes or they're working with microscopes, they're incredibly enthusiastic.
And what's amazing is when you have that degree in science, you don't necessarily have to be a bench scientist. You can go on and do science writing or science illustration and artwork, mm-hmm. or you can write books, or you can do a whole host of other things. The background gives you a way of looking at the world that's really important and exciting. So you can apply that in many ways.
That's exactly what I was getting to. I think, just as I think it's important to have a background in the arts, as I have, I think it's also really important to have a background in the science, because it does inform how you look at the world and how you interact with the world around you.
And so many of the things that are happening legislatively, things that are happening, decisions being made are based on science. And if you don't have that background, it's really hard to make intelligent decisions about them. So yeah, absolutely essential.
So would you like to see more scientists in elected office?
Stepping out, let me take this hat off here a second. I would. I think it's really a unique perspective, and mm-hmm. many other nations have scientists and engineers in elected office. They serve in government, and I think it gives a perspective that would be very valuable in any profession, really. So understanding that you have to be skeptical when you look at things, you have to have the data.
Exactly.
That's really important. It's easy also to fool yourself. And being experienced in saying, okay, I've got this data, it looks good to me, I need to really make sure I'm not fooling myself. That's a heck of a skill. We're getting comments from the peanut gallery here.
Yeah, I was just handed a note by Jeff Leonard, our station manager, who's kindly writing the board for me today to remind me that the Pope is a scientist.
Yes.
And we've had... science presidents. I think Jimmy Carter.
Well, he was. I know he worked in the nuclear field. I believe Naval Academy.
Naval Academy. Okay, right. All right.
George Washington was an engineer, so that's why he's.
I mean, our founders are Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, Benjamin Franklin. All of them had strong backgrounds in science, and I think that was for our benefit.
Absolutely. All right. So, personally, you.
Yes.
Star Wars or Star Trek?
I get this asked this every week.
Do you really?
I actually quite a bit.
A unique question.
I love Star Wars for the mythology. I think Star Wars is a story on the grandest of scales, mm-hmm. and it's sweeping. It's epic. I love that about Star Wars. Star Trek, I like because it's always based on we will get better.
Right.
We will get better as a species. We'll get better in our technology. And though the challenges are out there, we're going to make ourselves better. I love both those things. So they battle it out in my head. But yeah, I could probably say word for word every Star Trek episode from the original series. So I'm a geek, I know.
Excellent. All right. We'll talk about that off the air. We only have a few minutes left. But you're not. You just I mentioned a minute ago, you said you're taking your scientist hat off. You're not always a scientist.
No.
What else do you do?
What don't I do? Shout out to the Albemarle Morris men. I love Morris dancing. That's a lot of fun. Check us out.
So those are the guys who dress in white and
Hankies
try to hit each
sticks.
Other with sticks.
That's exactly it. manly men with manly sticks, drinking beer and having fun. Actually, one of the top teams here in town. They do a fantastic job. So mm-hmm. If anyone wants to join us, please do.
So as you consume more beer, does it get harder not to get clocked?
So much easier. As I say, it's a drinking club with a dancing problem. But they're a good group of guys. Definitely worth doing. I'm a part-time fitness instructor at ACAC, so I love doing that. I also have two artificial hips, so I do both of them with a little clink and a clank once in a while.
Right. You mentioned that on the way in. How did you get so what happened? Not to get too personal.
No, we're kind of born with bum hips, but I think 20 years of competition martial arts kind of took its toll.
And okay.
That got me.
All right. So, but with these artificial hips of yours, you've got something planned coming up.
Oh, yeah. Tough Mudder.
Yeah.
Gotta run. And actually, the NRAO, they send a team to Tough Mudder, Virginia, and they take it seriously. They do a great job. I did it with them last time, but I'll be on travel this year, so I'm going to do it on my own somewhere else.
See, I brought this up because I sort of want to shake up people's ideas of what a scientist is. You're not just guys in lab coats.
Oh, heck no. we're out causing trouble in the public, too. The NRA has got a great Tough Mudder team, and that's fantastic. It's going to be in Richmond, and they'll run that. Just out there having a good time.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Well, Charles, thank you so much for coming in.
It's been fun.
We'll definitely let's have you back.
Love it.
And we could talk more about talk more about what's in the sort of cutting edge of science. You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Sean McCord. I'll see you in about a month.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.